what happened was I spent 24 hours in the lounge in Yakutsk. And I met this dude. He was about my age, a couple of years younger. And he was a Russian guy. He was a lawyer. And he was trying to get, I think, to Moscow. And we ended up drinking vodka and eating fried eggs for 24 hours straight. And I don't drink, man, but I nothing else.
You were hungover. It wasn't COVID.
Dude. And it was vodka and cherry juice. So we were just shot of vodka, glass of cherry juice. Remember, when I drink, I have a drink or a beer over the course of the night. And after an hour, I have a pounding headache and I'm miserable. So I kind of just drank so much that day that I overcame that lousy feeling. Hey, I'm Steve Giordano.
And I'm Bob Allen.
This is Cockpit Casual, the podcast.
And we're here on week four, and I'm ready to watch basketball all day. So we got to get this podcast out of the way. I got basketball. I got University of Kentucky playing. It's March Madness time.
Man, I'm glad that your life is so easy right now that you get to watch basketball today, because I have a very full agenda of things that I have to do today. I know that you've had a busy week in comparison to me, but I'm stacked up with stuff to do today, man.
Oh, man, me too. Honestly, if I'm honest about it, I'm going to be sitting here at the computer most of the day, but I can do both at the same time. I can't just sit there and watch like a game. I just can't do it. My brain is too scattered to pay attention to a full game for all that time without something else going on. But
I'm not a big basketball watcher. No, I used to really be into the Sixers back in the Iverson days. I mean, pro basketball. You know, I live in really a sports town, so it's not really a college sports town. My stepdad's a big Seton Hall fan. So I grew up watching like Seton Hall and Big East basketball.
But oh, yeah,
man. Like basketball feels like most of the time, if it's a close game, nothing matters except for the last 2 minutes. So what do you have to watch the whole thing for?
That's pro basketball. I'm not a big pro fan, but I love college basketball. I grew up in Lexington, Kentucky. It's a religion out there.
Yeah.
You don't grow up there and not love basketball.
Yeah.
College basketball anyway. So I'll be watching the Wildcats today. Hopefully they do well.
So, we've had a really busy week. You've had a really busy week. You were traveling.
Yeah. Well, which I haven't even shaved like in, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. I've just been constantly traveling. You know, I took a 757 from Goodyear, Arizona to Tashkent, Uzbekistan. So we went all the way through, Wes Gardner and I. Gosh, that was, 17 hours of flying, and you know, then the time it takes to fuel and get things done. It was a long day. So, you know, we got there, went to the hotel. I crashed out for just about an entire day there.
So you guys didn't spend any time in Tashkent at all?
A little bit. I went out with some of the pilots that are starting that airline over there.
Okay.
So they took us out. They were Russian guys. So we went to a Russian restaurant and had Russian food.
Right.
And it was like good. What, I have like no idea what I ate. Yeah. Well, Wes had borscht. He had a big bowl of, you know, borscht, whatever that is. I don't know. What is that? Radishes or something?
No, it's beets. Borscht. I don't like borscht. It's a cold soup of like beets. To me, beets taste like dirt.
Yeah, me too. I don't like beets. I stay away from them.
Yeah, my grandfather was a huge, a big borscht eater. You know, my great grandmother, was Russian. I mean, she had a very strong accent, and she immigrated as a little girl. But like, I think they probably just spoke Russian in their house growing up. And I have memories of her. She died in 86, so I was 9 years old when she passed. But she was feisty, like a loud, crazy Jewish Russian grandmother. Her name was Minnie, Bubby Minnie. But anyway, he inherited that pickled herring and borscht. So he always was eating a bowl of borscht. Man, one wrong move with a bowl of borscht and your clothes are ruined.
Right, exactly. I don't, it must stain your insides too. I don't know. I just
beets are good for you. They're like really good for your heart.
Yeah, that's what they say. I don't know. They also give you kidney stones, I'm told. So I stay away from those things. Yeah.
Oh yeah, so, you get those.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. You know, pickled herring, we had all that kind of stuff. A lot of different grilled meat and stuff like that. It was good. I enjoyed it. It was great company too. It was cool talking to their pilots. One of them was Russian, was from Russia. One of them was from Ukraine.
How did that work?
Yeah, well, you know, we talked about it a little bit. It was interesting. You know, I mean, you know, it's, you know, how aviation, like, you know, it's just kind of a global society of people that all get along. I mean, we're kind of all cut from the same cloth and we're just kind of the same people worldwide.
For sure. And those guys are basically expats too, right? Like those guys, they don't live in Russia and Ukraine. They have kind of an outside view of what's going on. Obviously, I'm sure their families are in it, but.
Yeah. You know, for the most part, I mean, you're right. I mean, they, you know, most of the jobs that they've had over the last couple decades have been in other places. You know, they're true expats and true going around to, you know, wherever the jobs are.
Yeah.
It, you know, unfortunately for them, because they have Russian licenses, there's very few places that they can work. So Uzbekistan is one of them. But because of sanctions and different reasons, they can't, like, they can't work in Europe. They can't, you know, I mean, there's just, it's very finite.
We had some Russian contract pilots that we were using. So we used to do a ton of business in Russia. I mean, I've been to a lot of cities there. So I've been to Moscow, obviously, Arkhangelsk, you know, Krasnodar. I've been to Magadan, Yakutsk, Petropavlovsk, a lot on the Siberia side, Yakutsk.
And of course, Moscow.
Yeah. Anadyr. So, you know, and those were all different contracts. So Yakutia Airlines, we worked with, in Siberia, in Yakutsk, and they were state owned Dash 8s and 737s. We delivered both to them. We did all their maintenance flights and then lots of deliveries to a couple of different airlines that we used to work.
There was
Nordwind was one.
Yeah. Nordwind was one.
Russia.
What was the other one? There was,
Red Wings.
Yeah, Red Wings, and then there was another one that was, it was like half Turkish owned or something.
Azur.
What was that? Azur. Yeah. And then there was even another, I don't know. There was a lot of them. We did a lot of business in Russia. And I hope things get, you know, mended and everybody, you know, becomes peaceful again and starts doing business together. I mean, I would love to get back.
Yeah, it was a great market. It's a great country to visit. The people are awesome. I mean, different, right? Like, no BS.
Yeah, no BS. Kind of tough people, but you know, if you're, you know, on their side and part, you know, with them, they, you know, they just love you to death.
No BS and all BS at the same time.
And lots of vodka. Oh my
lots
God!
Of vodka. And cherry juice.
They tried to kill me a few times. I've learned my lessons in life, not to try to outdrink a Russian.
I got stuck in right before COVID. In fact, the joke in my house was that I was patient zero, although I don't think I had COVID. But anyway, like right at the end of 19, like December, like Christmas of 2019, COVID was still small news in the United States. Like, we heard about it. We knew that there were other countries having issues with COVID, but it wasn't really acknowledged yet in the U.S. It was just kind of like a, you know, page two story. And I was delivering a Dash 8 to Yakutia and I dropped it off and the weather went bad. You know, when the weather goes down in Yakutsk, it goes down. It's like a mile visibility. Less than a mile, a quarter mile visibility, freezing fog, negative 45 degrees Celsius. And the airport just kind of closes for days. And There was nowhere else to go out there.
There's only one really decent hotel.
That one that had the woolly mammoth in the lobby.
Yeah. The one they dug up out there somewhere.
Yeah. And then there's a couple of airport hotels, which all fill up when the airport closes. So I was stuck there. It was 2 days before Christmas. I was trying to get home for Christmas and the flights just kept getting canceled over and over and over again. I finally ended up on the 23rd of December getting on a Sukhoi Superjet that took off covered in ice, no de-icing. At this point, I didn't care. Went down to Irkutsk, jumped on a Korean Air, I think it was an S7 flight from Irkutsk to Seoul, and then I flew home on Korean, and I made it home on Christmas Eve evening. I remember specifically, and I was extremely sick for a week, but I don't think I actually had COVID. I think what happened was I spent 24 hours in the lounge in Irkutsk. And I met this dude. He was about my age, a couple of years younger. And he was a Russian guy. He was a lawyer. And he was trying to get, I think, to Moscow. And we ended up drinking vodka and eating fried eggs for 24 hours straight. And I don't drink, man. But I, nothing else.
You were hungover. It wasn't COVID.
Dude. And it was vodka and cherry juice. So we were just shot of vodka, glass of cherry juice. Remember, when I drink, I have a drink or a beer over the course of the night. And after an hour, I have a pounding headache and I'm miserable. So I kind of just drank so much that day that I overcame that lousy feeling.
If you had COVID, you killed it off.
Yeah. The only food they had left were fried eggs. So we were eating fried eggs and pickled cabbage. It was fun. So there's that story.
Yeah, I know. Well, there's lots of them and they just keep piling up. It's just like every time you go out, there's something new, a new lounge experience, a new, get stuck at an airport experience, whatever. Actually, I had a great experience this flight home from Tashkent. I took Uzbekistan Airways to Istanbul. Really? And it was business class, and it was, the old 222 business class on a 787. But, it was kind of old. I don't know. I mean, I don't care anything about the in-flight service or anything like that. I want to lay flat seat and just crash and go to sleep for the whole flight. But it was what was great, though, because, you and I went through Tashkent, through immigration, security and all that's, kind of hectic. And
you lost your ticket.
Yeah, I lost exact all of that stuff. It was like a miserable experience the previous time. This time we pull up to a VIP door, go through the VIP door and go in to a private, ticket counter that has a private security and private immigration. So it was like no stress at all. And then into a really nice lounge. Mm. And then they come get you and say, okay, time to go to the airplane.
Oh, man.
Get on. Then I went to Istanbul. And then what we were talking about last week, the airport lounges, I got to go back to the Turkish business class lounge and eat a ton of food.
What did you eat?
I don't know what any of it's called, but I ate some kind of different meats, and they've got a whole thing of some kind of salads, with hummus and baba ganoush or something. I went and had a little bit of everything, and I was stuffed. So then I got on the airplane, and they were like, oh, what do you want for dinner? I'm like, I don't want anything. I mean, it was a 13 and a half hour flight to Los Angeles from Istanbul. And
350 or 780?
No, they have a 350 and then they have a 777.
Okay.
I ended up on the 777, which is an older 222 or 232, actually, business class. But I had a good seat. It was a good ride.
Do they still do the chef outfit?
Yeah.
The flight attendant, yeah, the chef
you had,
outfit?
You had Chef Boyardee come out with the whole, you know, chef hat thing.
It reminds me of the Muppet Show, like the Swedish chef or whatever.
Yeah. And they're specifically there to be cooks. They're not like
regular flight attendants a costume?
It's not. That's what I thought. I was asking them about that. They're like, really? No, we're the chef. There's two chefs on board, and then there's flight attendants, and they have completely separate jobs.
But they have, but they're just, I mean, I'm assuming the aircraft are just regular, you know, steam ovens, dry heat ovens, like reheat ovens. So the stuff must be, I guess they're like, you know, just portion. We got to get a Turkish flight attendant on to, or pilot to come on and explain how that works.
Yeah, right.
I really would love to know. I mean, if you think about it, you fly Emirates, Qatar, Etihad, you get these gourmet meals. And I've always wondered, I guess they're back there just heating it up in the oven, and then they put it out on a nice piece of chunk. I mean, the presentation is everything, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And it's all flight attendants that bring out the, you know, the meals, you know, on Emirates or who, you know, everybody else. That I think Turkish is the only one that has designated chefs. And
yeah,
I don't know that you can actually do much cooking on an airplane.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's their thing.
Yeah. I remember once I was on a Korean Air, totally different subject, but A380, and which the whole upstairs is business class. So it's kind of not great. I hate that. There's too many, when there's so many business class seats, you don't get the same kind of service. Like, it still takes forever to get on and off the airplane. It kind of defeats the purpose of the exclusivity of it. But obviously there's more business class seats available. But anyway, I was positioned right next to the bar, and all flight, they were like mixing drinks and like, shaking like, you know, martinis and stuff.
Yeah, I know. That's so annoying. That's, you know, that's worse than sitting next to the bathroom, you know, next to a lavatory where people are going in and out and you can hear the thing flush. And,
I can tune it out. I just put on my AirPods and drift off to sleep, man.
I just sleep. I can sleep through just about anything.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, your trip seemed to be interesting. Actually, funny note. So the trip that you just did on the 7-5 freighter, Phoenix to Tashkent with Wes, I was going to go do it, but I ended up doing the 330 the week before you ended up doing this. Wes wanted to stay on the trip. We still do have another one too. So you and I will probably hopefully do the next one. But the funny thing is, so my week was like 80% cockpit casual. I started the next episode of Cockpit Casual finally. I've been in the, my process is like, I start looking at the footage. I start creating bins in Premiere, and I start importing like all the clips I like and labeling them. And I kind of draft up a general outline. So I've been doing that for a couple of weeks now, kind of slowly. I just haven't had the same kind of drive that I've had to do them, mainly because I've been doing this editing. By the way, we have to get a producer. I can keep doing the editing on this, but at some point, it takes a lot of my time. So, and I want to be able to still put out Cockpit Casuals, like at least at the same rate, if not at a faster rate. So, anyway, I've been kind of negligent with that.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you're taking on, you know, all the heavy load of the work. I mean, it's a lot of work just to sit down and get this done every week.
If there's anybody out there that has some experience producing podcasts, I'd love to interview you. So shoot me an email.
Yeah.
At least initially, I think somebody that could just handle the edit and start creating shorts and stuff like that, which we haven't been able to do.
Yeah.
That would take a lot of time off my schedule. So reach out. I don't know. We're soliciting the public here. Someone that has some experience, we'll pay you. I don't know what the going rate is. I'll have to do some research, but anyway, we need to do that, because in order for this to be long-term viable, I've got to get some help.
Yeah. Yep. I agree.
But anyway, I was producing Cockpit Casual, and I digressed there, but the episode that I'm working on is you and I on this exact same trip to Tashkent. And it's going to be cool, man. It's going to be really good. So I start the episode right now. Like I'm through like the first like 6 or 7 minutes roughly. And I start the episode kind of with, 'cause these airplanes, we have a history with them. we picked them up out of Roswell. They were all American Airlines 757-200 passenger aircraft, still in American livery, still with seats, business class. In fact, they all went out of service during COVID. So they still have in-flight magazines from like January 2020, February 2020.
Like all stuck in time.
Yeah. And then we flew them all to Xiamen, China. And then they sat there for 6, 7, 8 months, got converted to freighters. Then we flew them all back to Phoenix. And then they sat for a little while. So I start going into our history with them. I have a bunch of footage from those trips. Actually, one of them.
Very cool.
Yeah. One of those trips, I actually made a cockpit casual called Full Circle. It was you and I. We flew a 7.5 from Roswell to Xiamen. And then we hopped a flight to Italy. We picked up a 767 and then flew it back to Roswell. So we went Roswell to Roswell via the entire planet.
Oh, wow.
So that was a good one.
Did you get any footage with Neil?
I got a little bit of footage with Neil. Yeah. You know, but not on that trip.
Yeah. He wasn't really allowed to, you know, he was an airline, but so he's a good friend of ours that flew for us for like 20 years that passed away a few years ago. But he was involved in all these 757s. It was kind of funny. I mean, so the one I just delivered was the one that you and him had the engine failure on. We had an engine fire.
Number two in engine shutdown on our way into Guam.
Yeah. That's a whole other story that goes on and on with typhoons and you having to come right back to Asia. That was crazy. But yeah, I just thought, you know, in terms of any of the footage, it'd be cool to have Neil on any of those. Unfortunately, we couldn't do a lot of filming of him whenever he flew with us.
Yeah, he was an American Airlines pilot, and I guess they have a policy of no extracurricular flying. So he was just doing it. But he, he's gone now, so obviously it's okay. But yeah. Great, really good friend of ours, goes way back. Really terribly sad story, and
another Kentuckian, good friend of mine from Kentucky.
Yeah. So he and I flew that one. I didn't bring cameras on it because it was Neil. And I was like, what's the use if I have to hide the guy I'm flying with the whole time? There's no point in making it. And it's a shame because it was an interesting one. We picked it up in Roswell. We flew to Hawaii. We gassed up. I think we overnighted. Then we went to Guam for another fuel stop before we went into Xiamen. And about 80 miles out of Guam, I got a number two engine fire loop. Not a fire loop, a fire indication. So, you know, immediately the idea is it's probably a bleed leak. So we reduce the throttle, pull back to idle, didn't change anything. And, you know, we had started our descent into Guam and it really truly looked like it was going to be like a real fire because it didn't extinguish. You know, we're like, let's shut it down. We shut it down. The fire bell was still, well, we silenced it, but the lights were still on. And so after we shut it down, we caged it, secured it. We blew one bottle and the light stayed on. So I'm like, man, this thing is either actually burning or it's definitely an issue. So per procedure, we waited a minute and then we blew the other bottle. We put both bottles of Halon, you know, into the nacelle. And after the second bottle blew, the fire indication went off. So I'm like, wow. And
that was real. So you're thinking that's got to be real.
It's got to be real. And at that point, I was turning base to final nighttime into Guam. And we landed and we hit the deck and taxied over. They said no flames. We taxied over to the south side, I guess, actually. And we parked on that remote ramp. Fire trucks followed us. They said everything looks normal. We got out. They opened up the engine cowls. Everything looked normal. But then, of course, we were screwed because we had no fire bottle, no Halon left in Guam.
Yeah. They don't usually have fire bottles sitting around Guam for a 757.
Well, they did, but it was Asia Pacific Airlines maintenance, which they were awesome. They did. They came over and they helped. And then there's a staff mechanic over there in Guam that that helps us out. He's just great, man. He's proactive. Like sometimes we get there on any airplane and he's already topping off oil before we open the main cabin door. I mean, this dude,
yeah,
he's on it. But anyway, he looked at everything and we had an on-site team come out and assess. I think what ended up happening is the fire loop became disconnected somehow from the engine, and both loops contacted each other and somehow found their way up against like the hot section of the engine.
Oh, God.
And so it was just a transfer of temperature from the actual case of the engine to the loops. It was a freak thing. I mean, fortunately the engine was fine. It was just a matter of fixing the fire loop and then getting
the bottles.
Neil went home. He had to go back to work. You were flying that 787 into China,
into Tajikistan. Tajikistan. Yeah. I was flying the president of Tajikistan around in his new 787 from Mexico.
That was a cluster, man. And so we left.
That was insane.
4 days later, you and Wes show up. You guys fly out that 75 after they ended up getting new bottles.
In the middle of a typhoon. So
yeah,
we almost didn't get out. I mean, the typhoon was like literally, I mean, within like 20 miles of Guam. We were already
at 50.
We have 50 mile an hour winds while they were still working on the airplane.
I have a screenshot of you guys like a flight radar 24 screenshot, and the typhoon is spinning and you guys are like emerging. Oh, I just accidentally, this turns on the
AI. Oh, you started, yeah.
the typhoon essentially, hold on, let me fix my camera here. The typhoon, like you can see the swirls, and you were like shooting out of one of the swirls.
Yeah, we were definitely in a swirl. I mean, it was rough, man. Yeah, totally. I mean, look, if it would have been another 20 minutes, we wouldn't have been able to get out of there. I mean, they closed the airport. They were waiting for us to get the hell out of town so they could close the airport and everybody go home. I mean, I'm surprised everybody stayed out there at the airport still working on the airplane when, you know, I mean, they obviously had to get home and secure their homes and everything. It was a big typhoon, and I don't know, that airplane probably would have been destroyed had it sat there through it.
Guam Airport sustained damage.
Yeah.
There was flooding.
Yeah, all those hotels, everything, you know. There was no water, no power. It was a mess. It would have been a disaster to have stayed there. I mean, we're on the takeoff roll, and I just said, Wes, I said, I don't care what happens. Here's the brief. No matter what happens, we're going to continue to somewhere. We're not coming back here. And yeah. I'm not aborting this takeoff.
Yeah. I know. But you guys didn't even go to Xiamen. You went to Manila or Clark.
You went
to the Philippines.
Yeah, we went to Clark Air Base.
Wes didn't have his China visa was expired.
So we had just been in China the previous week with that 787. Wes had a visa for that. He didn't realize.
It was single entry, right?
Until like we were pretty much about to take off. That it was single entry. So he couldn't get back into China. So we called you and said, Steve,
it was 3 a.m.
Yeah.
It was 3 a.m. and my phone just rang and rang. And finally I woke up.
You need to get on the next flight. Next flight to the Philippines, because this airplane's going to be there and you're the only one with a visa.
Yeah.
So
I remember I woke up an hour, I woke up at like 3 a.m. and within an hour I was dressed. I had a ticket to Manila via Tokyo. I drove up to Newark, flew Newark, Tokyo, Manila. I met you as the middle of the night, and then we dropped it into China. So that was crazy. It was impulsive. Like I had to change. I had to like pick up my son from school. I had a bunch of stuff going on that day. So I had to like split. It was like a short call reserve to go to China.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that whole trip was just so crazy. I mean, I'm still amazed that it all came together and we got that airplane out of Guam.
That was the one where I also ordered balut for you for catering.
Yeah. I think we have some video of that as well.
I'll put that on the video episode of you and I opening a balut.
Yeah. Yeah. If if you all out there don't know what balut is. It's a, I guess, I don't know, is it a delicacy or is it just kind of a staple food in the Philippines?
I think it's a staple. It's not expensive. It's a fertilized embryo, a duck embryo. Yeah.
It's a baby chicken inside of an egg.
Oh gosh, Jesus. Can't look.
Oh man, this is not solid.
Oh!
Oh! Ah, man, it's getting all over my hands.
Wash them.
It's disgusting.
Just cut the whole thing in half.
Oh, God! Oh, fuck! Oh, God!
Dude, eat it.
Sorry, man, we're looking at balut.
You eat this?
Yes,
you eat it?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I don't know.
We have three more. Do you want them?
He's like, no.
Oh, good. Oh, God.
Is that
oh,
the head?
That's the head.
I think that's the head.
It's the fucking head. Oh.
Oh, my God. It stinks.
Duck or chicken or, yeah.
Yeah, something. But, yeah, I mean, you open up this gross egg. It's like a boiled egg. Or was it even boiled? I can't even remember. It was all goopy, wasn't it?
It looks like.
I don't know.
I mean, it looks like organs inside of a with a head and feathers.
Yeah there's know, definitely like a beak and some big eyes.
I mean, they just shoot it. They just, we gotta ask Pat Roa about that. I mean, he eats them. I mean, he's Filipino. Yeah. You know.
Yeah
no thanks. We opened it. We did not have the cojones to eat it.
It smelled kind of weird.
I mean, it didn't actually smell too bad. It just looked bad. If I were starving, I would definitely eat it. So anyway, that airplane you just delivered to Tashkent, we delivered one. There was, I think there was four or five of them total.
Yeah.
The cockpit casual that I'm making is the last one that we delivered. And we have a fair bit of flight footage, but we have great footage of walking around Tashkent. We went to the outdoor market, where the spices and the meats and
really old mosque. There was like an old mosque that they were still
bazaar, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Korshu, that bazaar was the bazaar was bizarre.
And then we ate
all the spices and stuff, spices and like fruit and an unbelievable amount of horse meat. I don't know how much footage you got of that. I was kind of afraid to open my camera inside.
It's going to be like a reverse version of the last cockpit casual where we were in Oman. So we started in Oman and like the first 15 minutes was us cruising around Muscat. This episode, it's going to be like the first 15 or 20 minutes will be the flight. And then the remainder of the episode, I have enough to probably do another 20 or 30 minutes of just cruising around Tashkent, which I think was awesome.
Yeah.
We're just walking around the streets. The subway was super interesting.
Subway was way cool.
So that it's going to be good. I hope to have this one out by summer. And then I'm going to also, I want to release it with another trip that I'm going to make of me and Pat Lewis, where we flew a part out 320. From the States to China, and then we picked up a 737 and flew it from the China back to the States. So no airline flights. It was just us under our own power to China and back. And that was the one where I had all kinds of problems with the airplanes. I was out there taping the calendar together. So I'm going to make those two, and those are going to be the next drops. So
good. Those will be interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing those.
So anyway, what we did, we don't have a full like regular episode prepared. We have an interview we did with Scotty Bateman, and it was great. Scotty was talking about his new book, Jumbo. Talked about his military career in the RAF, a little bit about his time flying 747s for British Airways. Now he's on the A350 over there. Scotty is just an awesome guy.
Yeah, we gotta have him back just to sit here and just talk with us. I mean, he can just tell stories just like this. I mean, he's a great person. I love just sitting around talking to Scotty.
I know, me too, man. And he's got that accent. It's not even, I mean, he's Scottish, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like a heavy, like London
it's
British.
It's not like Cockney. Like, it's like a Scottish accent. I like the Scottish accent. It's
good. Yeah. He's a good guy.
Definitely. So right after this, we're going to roll right into our interview with Scotty Bateman. I think it was about 40 minutes long. It was a great interview. So enjoy, and we'll see you next week with a more complete episode, kind of under the format that we normally do, other than us just BSing and then rolling into an interview.
Which is good too. I don't mind sitting here BSing. Hopefully everybody enjoys it as well.
Yeah, and I still have like 25 questions that I just organized that we're going to get to next week, because we talked too much on this episode once again. But anyway, we'll figure it out.
And I've got some cockpit shtick.
Some side shtick?
Questions. Cockpit shtick. Yeah, side shtick for questions for you. So
you want to save that for next? We want to give us
next week teaser. Let's save it for next week.
Save it for next week. Okay. Sounds good, everybody. Enjoy the interview with Scotty Bateman, and then we'll see you next week.
See y'all.
Bye. Scotty Bateman, you skinny guy, you.
I feel a bit skinny now. Oh, God, yeah.
He's getting younger by the day.
No, older by the day, sadly.
I don't think so. Steve and I are the ones getting older. You keep getting younger every time I see you.
Oh, I know, man. God, you look great.
Oh, thanks, mate. Yeah, six stone. So in real money, that's probably it's 35 kilos, so about 70 pounds I've lost.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
You lost 70 pounds?
Yeah.
I got to take some notes on how you did. I got to lose like 20.
You don't want what I had. Trust me. You do not want what I had. Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's good to see you, Scotty. I mean, we go back pretty far. You know, it's funny. So here's how I found out about Scott Bateman. Okay. In 2016, I joined Twitter for the first time. I had no social media. I'd been off of Facebook for years and years and years. And I ended up, it was the presidential election, the Trump election. And everyone was always talking about Twitter. Yeah, everybody was talking about Twitter. So I'm like, all right, I'll log on to Twitter and I'll set up an account. So I set up an account, and you know, it used to ask you like what you're into, and then it recommends followers. So I put like, I mean, the only thing I'm into is like aviation and Philly sports, and Scotty Bateman was like the recommend. So I followed Scott, and you were like I think you were like at least my first 10 follows on Twitter. Yeah, so like my aviation Twitter.
I was into the Phillies. Obviously.
Yes, probably that. Nothing to do with aviation. So anyway, that was back in 16. And I think it really took about, I mean, it was weird. When I started with Twitter, I was a watcher. I was like a Twitter voyeur. And I was getting a lot of aviation stuff on my feed, but, I just started posting aviation stuff, and then like the account blew up because people were like, you do what, you know? And that's kind of how it all started for me. And so like you were kind of in on that from the beginning, and then we ended up talking at some point. I don't remember exactly when, but we've maintained contact over the years. I mean, you're in all kinds of media stuff in aviation, and as am I, like at this point.
You do more than I do now.
I don't know. Scott, you've been in some very legitimate things. Well, not that Steve's been in illegitimate things, but.
Is this niche videos again, Bob?
Yeah.
Quite a bit of illegitimate stuff. I mean, but there's been a couple of legitimate things. Nathan
the
Fielder.
TMZ. TMZ one comes to mind. Yeah.
Your YouTube stuff is amazing. That's legitimate. It's really good.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, it's good. It's illegitimate doesn't mean bad. It just means, you know, fun. Not recognized.
Mostly. Yeah.
Not as mainstream as what you've been in.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, we go back pretty far. We've never actually met in person yet. That's going to change soon.
Bob and I have.
We have. Oh, yeah.
Really? How did that happen?
Oh, yeah.
On one of his Phoenix layovers.
Yeah.
What was it last year?
We went for a beer and some wings and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, downtown
Phoenix. Even you didn't know that, Steve.
I didn't know that. I don't know everything Bob does. Most of the stuff I know. Every now and then I'm surprised. But we almost met. We almost got all of our wives and all of us together.
Oh,
we were
in London. And I crashed my car.
And you crashed your car.
I don't remember that.
I had to get a new car as a whole result. But I loved that car. And it got... We hit a tire, a wheel on the motorway, driving to come to you, and the car was wrecked.
Yeah, was it a Volvo?
Do I remember?
It was a Volvo.
Luckily, it was a Volvo, and that, you know, it was high enough off the ground that the tire went underneath and just wrecked the car and didn't wreck us.
God.
We were so lucky. But I mean, I'd forgotten all about that.
Yeah, yeah, I had my wife Avery there, Bob's wife Laura, and you and your wife were going to meet us for dinner. We had reservations at like this nice place in London. I was stoked, finally going to meet Scotty Bateman, and my phone rings and he says that he was in a car wreck, and I'm like, no way.
Yeah, sure.
What kind of excuse is this?
He sent pictures.
No, I did actually send you pictures from the side of the motorway, didn't I? Yeah.
Yeah, you did.
My car in bits.
Yeah.
We wanted proof.
Yeah. So anyway, Scott is the king of all aviation media, really, truly. And he just published his second book called Jumbo. And I haven't gotten my copy yet. And I noticed, I shit you not, I got an email from Scotty's publisher saying that both myself, Bob, and Richard Branson did not get their copies.
Wow.
I don't know if that was for real or what. Was that real?
No, that actually was for real. You are in good company. He didn't get his either.
I think I'm going to call Richard and see if he got his yet.
Yeah.
So you are in good company, yeah. But here it is, if you haven't seen one. This is what it looks like.
Jumbo. Yeah. I have not seen one. You did send me the manuscript, which I've been reading. It's not, you know, it's not quite as handheld, but I've been scrolling it on my iPad on some trips that I've been doing over the last couple of weeks. So I can get at least up to speed enough to ask you about it. And I want to talk about that, but I want to kind of talk first. So your first book was Herc. So you came from the RAF. You were a Royal Air Force loadmaster and then pilot.
Yeah, so started out as a loadmaster back in the 1990s. Oh my God, do you remember then?
Oh wow!
I mean, I was in high school then. Bob was already an old man.
So hey, yeah, I started in the Air Force in 1990, and then as a loadmaster, and you know, 5-6 years later, became a pilot in the Air Force. Went back to fly the Hercules as a co-pilot, and then as a Hercules captain. And then finished there and went off to fly the subject of the next book, which was Jumbo. So that's kind of my career in a nutshell there.
Hold on. I want to touch on a couple other things from that period. So first of all, in the US, loadmaster is an enlisted position. I assume, is it the same? Is it the same in the RAF?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. So you enlisted in the RAF, in the '90s, and so how did you transition to, like, did you go to like officer basic school?
Yeah. Or? So started off as a, what we call sergeant air crew. So a senior NCO, a sergeant, and as a loadmaster, and then went from when I was commissioned as a pilot, I went and did 8 months at the RAF college, came out of that as an officer, it gives you some credit for being an enlisted guy before, so you come out as the equivalent of what you would have as a captain. And then you go
like
then
an 03.
An 03, then into pilot school.
Is that an unusual career, military career trajectory, or is that
there are a lot, it's not common, but there are a lot of people who go from airman air crew, whether that be flight engineer or loadmaster. Not so many flight engineers around now, but there were back when we had Hercs and stuff. But they used to, because they have great airmanship, all those things that make piloting easy, because if you've got all that stored away, all you've got to do is really focus on the stick and rudder skills. So a lot of people went from those roles, commissioned, and went into piloting, particularly when we had a pilot shortage in the sort of the mid-90s. The Air Force deliberately targeted those guys, particularly those who'd applied for pilot before and I'd applied and been turned down previously. So they invited me back. I had another go and lo and behold, got the job.
So you weren't a private pilot or anything. You were just a loadmaster, no stick time, zero. You had an interest in aviation. You were pursuing the path, but like your first hour was in an RAF trainer.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. I hadn't done anything prior to this. I'd had a little go at the HERC every now and again, you know, when you're in the cruise and you have a little go. Yeah. but I'd never really done any formal training prior to starting. And I started on the Slingsby Firefly, the T-67 Firefly, little single engine piston airplane. Yeah. And then I moved from that to the, because I was going to go back to Maltese. I always knew that. I went from that to the Jetstream.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Flew the Jetstream for a bit and then jumped from that to a HERC.
Bob is a Jetstream guy, by the way. Bob flew the J-32?
The 3100.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Bigger than the ones I flew. The ones I flew were like the T2, which it had like seven seats in the back or something.
Oh, it was
really small.
Airplane. It's an airplane that has multiple cocks.
Couple sitting at the front, perhaps.
No, seriously.
I'm told that's an English term.
So the valves on the Jetstream in the manuals are called cocks.
They are.
I always found that funny because I'm very immature.
Well, you can't be mature and a pilot at the same time, can you?
No, this is true.
Not possible. So you started off flying the cock plane, and then you worked your way over to the C-130, which is an American-built aircraft, therefore no cocks. And you were deployed in Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah. I've done a lot. Iraq, Afghanistan, Sierra Leone. I did a long time on that airplane through probably one of the most kinetic times, I think, in our lifetime in terms of wars. My entire operational career was one war after another, you know, whether it be the Balkans or through into, you know, the Gulf, first Gulf War, second Gulf War, Afghanistan, towards the end of my career. So, you know, there was a lot of operational flying.
How many years were you in?
So I did service. 18 years in the RAF.
Oh, okay.
Total. Wow. Yeah. Didn't leave till 2008. And then went straight into airline flying and flying the jumbo, which was a bit of a jump because I went from a turboprop, never having flown a jet in my training or anything like that, to flying a almost 500 ton, four engined, you know.
Yeah. Jet. What was that transition like?
Tough. It's bizarre. Well, you've both flown turboprops. You've both flown jets. So
I went dash 8 to MD 80. So, I mean, it didn't have the mass, but yeah.
So difficult. Pitch controls speed instead of power. And, you know, and it's all the wrong way around, isn't it?
Yeah. Energy management.
Yeah. And it was tough to begin with, but you quickly get the hang of it because you do a lot of it, and it was great fun. I went from, you know, one military icon to literally the civilian aviation icon that blew all others out the water. I was so lucky.
From what I understand, from reading your book, you sustained an injury in Kabul, Afghanistan at the Bagram Air Base, a place that I've been, by the way. I dropped the Dash 8 there, a couple of them years back. So war zone, combat injury by falling in the shower.
Slipping in the shower on it was, we can laugh. I can laugh about it now. I did not laugh about it at the time, I can tell you. I cannot describe. If you've ever been deployed with the military, and you know, probably college football bathrooms after a game are probably the same kind of state, you know, it's absolutely a quagmire. It's covered in detritus and bits of people and all sorts. So I went into the shower with my flip-flops on because nobody wants to step in other people's stuff. So I go in the shower, have a wash, I get out the shower, fine, put my towel on, start to dry myself, think, I've left my shower gel in the shower. And I turn back to get my shower gel and slip on my ass.
And that was back injury.
Yeah, and I landed on the lip of the shower tray, right in the middle of my back. And it did smart at the time, and I got by for a couple of days. I went and did a couple of operational sorties, and then it just got sorer and sorer and sorer. And one day I was flying with a doctor, and he said, "Oh, come and have a look. Well, you know, come across to the hospital and have a look. We'll have a little prod around." And I'd done it in properly.
Yeah. You know what, man? It's probably the thing that is most likely to kill us on a trip is a slip in the shower. I mean, seriously, hear about it all the time. You know, able-bodied people coming out of the shower. And, I mean, you know, some of these hotels that we're at, like, you don't know. It's not your own home bathroom, right?
I know. And you're not used to it. And I take a lot of care now in the shower. I can tell you.
Bad it can go.
Yeah, you do not want that to happen again. And I was super lucky. I had some amazing care. I got some amazing aftercare through the military. It brought an end to my military career, sadly. But it didn't restrict me moving forward into a civilian one, which was fantastic. And that was largely due to the rehab and stuff that was provided.
Is that something that, I mean, obviously your life probably flashed before your eyes when you realized how severe of an injury it was, thinking that this could be the end of your medical as well. I mean, in the EASA, medical is no joke, especially compared to the FAA.
I was really lucky in that, you know, at one point during all of this, I couldn't actually walk. You know, I'd lost the feeling in my left leg and stuff. And I was super lucky that the surgeons were able to sort all that out, and I've been left with some lasting effects, but nothing that impact me day to day, really, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like you're exercising a hell of a lot more than me.
Not eating. I'm not exercising. It's a simple maths game. Calories in versus calories out. You just don't eat, Steve, and the weight drops off.
That's hard for me, but maybe it's time for me to restrict the eating a little bit.
Yeah, I can't keep track of it. I don't know what day it is.
So you get hired by British Airways after the medical debacle. You're processed out. You haven't flown in some time at this point, I'm assuming.
Probably about a year I hadn't flown.
At all?
At all, yeah.
I'm assuming British Airways hires quite a few military folks coming out of the RAF.
Yeah, at that time they had a pathway, which basically allows people to go straight from the military in with an interview and a few other things. But you can do that well ahead of your exit date so that you know you've got a job and stuff. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Very cool. So you go into training, you're assigned the 747. At what point do you find out? You go to INDOC first and then you find out?
It's bizarre. I don't know what they do now, but back then they used to phone you up and they used to make you a verbal offer over the phone. And they used to say, "All right, we'd like to start on this day," and blah, 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 blah. And everybody's like, On what plane? And I kind of knew it was going to be a long haul airplane because of my experience, because I'm qualified for zero flight time because of the HERC time, I was kind of hoping for the jumbo, but never knew. And she says, "Will the jumbo be okay?" And I was like, "Yes, yeah." So I accepted the offer straight away, and we were in. It was great.
What year was that?
2008.
2008, you go into British Airways, you're right on the jumbo. What is your first takeaway in training? Now, I mean, so for full disclosure here, Bob and I are typed on a lot of different airplanes. The 747 is not one of them. So I'm not going to be able to, I mean, we have plenty of Boeing experience. I don't necessarily know, just keep it in your mind that I don't know a whole lot about that airplane.
It's fine. So all you need to know is it's a Boeing. And all Boeings are relatively the same, whether it be the 777, the 76, 75 is a bit of a rocket ship, isn't it? But
yeah,
all of them are generally the same. And the systems are generally the same. And the jumbo's no different. The jumbo's just got four of everything. It's got four hydraulic systems, four engines, four main gear, You know, it is built to last. The only thing that surprises you and still surprises me today when I go and sit in, you know, ones that are in museums is how high you are off the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And nobody, I think, ever gets used to that. Even taxiing around, you know, you're on the third floor of a building taxiing around. When you touch down, when the main wheels touch, your eye height is 117 feet. So you're still 117 feet in the air when the main gear touches down. Most airplanes are about the 55 feet off the ground type thing. Even the big triples are about that. But yeah, 117 feet is your eye height when you touch down.
So that's definitely one of the tougher things, like with our job, is that we move around between types so often that means, you know, I mean, and we don't get into, I don't get into dash eights as much as I used to. The dash eight is a low rider. I mean, you're like on the deck. And then of course we have the west wind.
The west wind.
Yeah. So we have the west wind, which is like the lowest of all airplanes. It's lower than, I mean, it sits, the cockpit.
It's lower than a Cessna 150.
In our hangar, the west wind sits next to our Cherokee 140. And the Cherokee 140's cockpit is higher off the deck than the west wind. So, yeah. So
I'd be flaring so high that we could probably, you know. I'll tell you a story about this.
Bob can't even land.
For runway, I can.
I did some stuff with Beechcraft, and we went to the factory in Wichita in Kansas, and I flew out to Denver. They picked us up in a 350, King Air 350, took us across to the factory. We did a couple of days at the factory doing some stuff, and on the way back, the guy said, "Oh, you're a qualified pilot." He said, "Do you want to fly the King Air on the way back?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course." So I fly this King Air, come around, we come to Denver, we're doing it. He says, "What do you want to do, a visual or an ILS?" I said, "I think I'm going to do an ILS, just to get the hang of it. It's been a long time since I've gone to turbo." Coming down, and it 100, and I started to flare in the King Air at 100, because that's kind of what you were doing the jumbo. And the guys, I tell you what, you have never seen the guy's hands move in the other seat so quick in your life. What the fuck are you doing? And it's like, and one of my buddies was, I've got this video and I will share the video with you. The guy from the back, basically looking at the front, you see the thing go like this.
Yeah.
As he's trying to stabilize it out after I tried to flare it at 100 feet, it was not good. And I learned about, let other people do the landings.
Right. Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, and like, you know, for landing, it's one thing. I mean, what we learn to do is really, really trust in the radar altimeter callouts. I mean, but still, even at 100, you get a 100 in a jumbo, that's when you start pulling the power back. I mean, no airplanes that I fly do you start pulling the power back at 100, even in the triple. I mean, you know, maybe like between 150 somewhere, but not really. I mean, you're still kind of coming down slow. So with four engines spooling down and everything else, like it takes a while, I guess, for the thrust to come out.
Lot of energy there as well.
And the 7.4 is tons of lift, not only from the wing, but from the fuselage itself, right?
Yeah. And you know, you look at the wing, that, you know, that was one of the Sutter's great inventions, was that wing. You know, it's got a 37 degree sweep. I don't think there's any airliner now that has that kind of sweep, 37.5 degree sweep. It was optimized to fly at 0.855 with that sweep. That's why. So they wanted a high speed wing, but to make it land at some of the smallest airports, you know, they wanted to have this triple slotted flap. So you've got triple slotted Fowler flap, plus leading edge flaps, not slats, flaps that come out the front, Krugers that come out the front. When you look at the wing with the flap down, the flap 30, it is enormous, this wing. And it, all that air is getting re-energized by those slots and the flaps. So it just produces a phenomenal amount. And literally, you could almost sit in ground effect with no power on, and it'll just keep going.
What's a normal ref speed for land? Well, first of all, what's a normal weight landing? Let's call it a full load of passengers, but very little fuel.
250 tons.
250 tons.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's about right.
So you're at 500,000 pounds. landing, like after burning fuel. What's your rev speed in that thing with all those flaps?
I seem to recall it'd be about 135, something like that.
So
yeah,
like any other airplane.
They're all the same. They're all the same.
Any other, not the West Wind. The West Wind's like 140.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, the 350 is about the same that I fly now, but the 380 is even slower because of the size of the 380 wing. It's quite slow. Yeah. I mean, it really, really is slow.
Yeah. I mean, the 7.5 is that way. It always shocks me whenever I'm in the 7.5. You can get refs like below 110 empty. Like, you know, we're empty. Well, we're empty, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking about you might have 10,000 pounds, 8,000 pounds of fuel left in the airplane landing somewhere. You're at ref like 112 or maybe like 109.
Yeah, I had a 107 going into Phoenix the other day.
Wow. That's like Cessna speed.
I still flew it at 125, though.
Yeah, I know. But you look at the jumbo, and you think about those speeds, and it's why the airplane looks so enormous, and it looks like it's just sitting there. People go, "Oh, it's going to fall out of the sky." It's because it's so big and it's going so slow. People just go, "My goodness," you know. And really, that's we talk about it in the book, but it's one of the few airplanes that's now that people still stop and stare at because they go, "Wow, that's enormous." Whereas I don't think the 380 has that kind of a
no.
It doesn't. It's a pretty airplane. It's a timeless look. It is. You know, I like any other Av geek, I've been kind of emotional about the last of them, and I still try to get on them whenever I can. I was actually on Air China 74-8 recently. I mean, you know, I wanted to fly on a 7.4 if I flew on Air China.
Yeah, you must have been really desperate.
Desperate. Well, and it was a good price.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I've flown the Lufthansa one a few times, the Air China, Korean. I've been on three jumbos in the last year, three of those carriers.
The only eight I've been on is the new Air Force One, the VC-25B.
Really?
So that's the only eight that I've been on. And I have been privileged, and we talk about it in the book, to be one of the few people who've actually been on that airplane. I was there the day that the Air Force took it over, signed it over from Boeing. I was the first person to step across the threshold of it when it was a VC-25B. Then the Air Force signed it back to Boeing Defense, another company, and a couple of Boeing Defense pilots with a couple of Air Force pilots standing behind them flew it from out of the desert, actually. Down to Big Texas, which is just south of Austin.
So yeah. this is part of the documentary that you did. Is that correct?
That was Air Force One, The Flying Fortress, which is on Nat Geo.
Yeah.
And we did a document. Yeah.
So to back up from that, something I've always been curious about is how you started the airline career. You're on the jumbo. How did you become this like world-renowned expert on the jumbo and then end up, you know, making these documentaries about Air Force One? It's always fascinating.
A bit of luck, Bob, actually. So I wrote a book for the 50th anniversary of the jumbo. I wrote a book, and the book was appalling, right? So it was a book written by a pilot. For pilots. It was such a technical book that it'd have been a snooze fest for anyone reading it apart from a pilot.
Scott, this is the evolution of Cockpit Casual. You look at the first few episodes and I'm talking about like, I'm using acronyms and I'm saying, and I feel like I'm teaching a ground school and I'm like, man, people aren't going to want to see this. I totally get what you're saying there.
So I try to pitch this book, try to get it sold. Guess what? Nobody wanted it. A friend of ours, we had dinner with a friend of ours, and she says, "Oh, I know a guy. You know, go and have lunch with this guy." I went and had lunch with this guy called Alan Haling. In fact, I had lunch with him yesterday again. So, you know, we've been good friends for a long time now. And basically, Alan says, "Oh, I don't think this is a good book, really." And I'm like, "Oh, no. Tell me what."
Thank you.
"Tell me what I don't know." He said, "But," he says, "I love the bit about Air Force One in the book. Because I wrote a big piece about Air Force One." He says, "We could turn that into a documentary." And I went, "I know nothing about documentaries and I can't even sell my book. How am I going to do TV? And he says, "Well, I might have a bit of insight into that." And what Alan didn't tell me prior to the meeting was that actually him and his wife owned a Warner Brothers production company. And we went and we sold this documentary within 2 weeks to Nat Geo on the caveat that we got access to the president and to Air Force One, the old one and the new one. And I used and my network and a number of friends and stuff, and eventually we got access to the old Air Force One or the existing aircraft through my Air Force contacts. We managed to arrange that, and then I ended up getting the opportunity to speak to some of the president's staff in Washington on a layover, and literally over a text, he agreed to do it. And
wow.
So we ended up getting access not only to the existing Air Force One, to the new ones, which literally they'd bought but hadn't taken delivery of at that point. They were still out in the desert. And then we had the opportunity to interview 45/47 on the airplane.
So as part of that documentary. We're an apolitical podcast, so I'm not going to go too far down this rabbit hole. But you met Donald Trump
briefly. Yeah, I didn't get to interview him, sadly, because they changed the days and I had to do some real work. So actually we sent someone else to interview him on the day, but,
I
tell you what, I don't care what anyone says, and I'm, you know, perhaps not his greatest fan either, but he was very generous with his time, for the interview. He didn't have to give us the time for his interview. And, you know, we did probably an hour and a half with him, of which there's probably 6 or 7 minutes, I think, in the documentary. He was generous with his time and very generous to allow us to be on both aircraft. He could have just said no. And for that, you know, I'll be ever grateful. And I think that because of what we did there in that documentary and how well that came out, I think perhaps there was some influence for the next documentary that we did, which was actually with NASA, which was fantastic as well. You know, perhaps not. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it was a great time.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
I would have imagined that. Like, I mean, of all the things, and again, I'm not going to get into any of the political stuff, but I mean, he seems a lot more interested in non-presidential stuff than presidential.
Right, I feel now, like it would probably right, be a good conversation.
Now we're getting political.
No, it's not political. I mean, I feel like
Steve
I feel
had
like
to get it in there.
No. I feel like I'm legit here. I feel like it would be interesting to play a round of golf with Donald Trump, and I would do it. I think I would.
I think, and this is I'm perhaps way off the mark here, but he is a bit of an aviation geek.
Is he?
So, you know, his
brother was a pilot.
And he's taken a lot of interest in his own aircraft and, you know, his 727, his 75 and 74. And if you ask him which one he prefers, he actually says the 727 because where he sat, it was one of the quietest airplanes he's ever flown on. So
everyone loves the 72. The 72 VIP. Remember, we dealt with one for the Tan Sri over in Malaysia, right?
Yeah.
And he would not part with the 7-2. All of his advisors were like, maintenance escalation is high. Let's just get a BBJ.
Nope.
Wanted a 7-2. And when that 7-2 aged out, they bought another 7-2.
I think it was Donald Trump airplane.
Oh, was it? Oh, did he fly that one? Oh, right. Wow.
Yeah.
So we were just talking, actually, Steve, prior to coming on this podcast, I was talking with Bob about somebody who we know who actually has about three of these 7-2s. None of them fly, but he taxis them around all the time to use fuel up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
great VIP guy.
7-2s. Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting character, Mark Gregory.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the guy that we got to take the cameras out there.
It's only just up the road from where I live, and he has a jumbo there, one of the ones that I flew, actually.
Oh really? We've got to go out there. He's such an interesting, nice guy. I love talking, sit there and talk to him for hours. So getting him on and recording him and some of his stories and just see, you know, I'm getting off on a tangent here.
You could film it whilst you're driving the 727 around the airfield. Now that would be a podcast to go to watch.
Absolutely.
So back to the 74 before we wrap it up here. So you were there for the last 747 to come off the line. Is that correct? There was a ceremony there?
Yeah. So I was very fortunate. So the book was written in partnership with Boeing. The former Boeing commercial airplane CEO did the foreword, and the Boeing historian did the afterword, and they supported us through all of it, including the images and stuff like that. So we're really grateful to Boeing for all the support they give us for the book. And one of the things that we wanted to do was to be there for the key moments of the last airplane. So I was there for the laying down of the keel, the first wing spar, which was done on the 9th of February, which was a key date because that was the date of the first flight as well. So they laid down the last spar for the first airplane on that date. And then we followed it for a TV program, which is actually on Paramount Plus in the US, called The Last 747. And we followed the build of the last airplane from the laying down of that spar all the way to rolling out the factory. And it was amazing to be there for both, and for the handover of the airplane to Atlas at the end. It was an amazing ceremony. I've never been to anything like that in my life. Boeing really did, you know, did it proud, showed the old girl off, as it were. And you know, John Travolta turned up.
So you saw the last 747 delivered. We narrowly missed you for that because it wasn't us personally. We moved the last Air India 747 out. And it wasn't us personally. We hired, because we're not 747 rated, but we hired some of our contract guys to go do it. And it was like unbelievably high profile.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't know it ahead of time.
Right.
Yeah. Everything to do with the last jumbos, whether they were, you know, from Europe, whether the United's last jumbo, you know, all of them. I mean, I just don't think there is an airplane that people feel that way about now. You know, it's one of the aviation icons. I mean, it really did. And I wax lyrical about it in the book, but it changed the world. You know, whether it really did, you know, it democratized travel. You know, we've already talked about Air Force One. You know, we had firefighting aircraft that were 747s. You know, it's even fueling the missions to the moon now. Sophia, which was NASA's jumbo, found the ice on the moon, which means if you've got ice, you've got water and hydrogen. So that's, they said, you know, we can go now to the moon and stay because we can have oxygen and we can have fuel for hydrogen to allow us to go to Mars in the future. So the whole of the Artemis program was facilitated by a jumbo jet. So again, it's not just changing our planet, it's changing the other planet.
That's really interesting. It's incredible, and it's just because it's the end of the 747 era. I mean, there will be other aircraft eras, but I don't know that an era will be as defined by a single aircraft rather than a class of aircraft. It's never been about a single type except for the 747. I mean, I think there was hype that the A380 would be that way, but it wasn't.
No, I just... The thing is that the genesis of the 747 was the failure of something else. You know, the genesis of the 747 was the failure effectively of supersonic travel in the US, the Boeing 2707. The 747 was always going to be an also-ran, they thought back then, because we'd all be flying around supersonic at the moment, you know, in Concords and 2707s and whatever. That just didn't happen in the way people thought. And then, lo and behold, they had to find an also ran, which was the jumbo. And, you know, you went from the 707, which carried 100 people, you know, ish, and didn't go very far or very fast. Then you've got the first wide bodied airplane, high bypass engines. It can land on the same airports and do three times the distance in, you know, two thirds of the time. And
one would say that it's economically driven, right? I mean, the reason that the supersonic did not make it and the jumbo became like this legacy aircraft has got to come down to economics. I mean, you know, you can fill a lot of seats. You can make a lot of money. You can cover a lot of distance, less frequency, single flights. I mean, is that the key to the success of the jumbo?
It was the key to it. It democratized it because, you know, you're putting three times as many people on a jet that's burning the same amount, if not a little bit less fuel. You know, looking at it now, this next statement will seem utterly ridiculous, but back then the 747 was the most ecological option. Yeah. Because it had high bypass engines, it was low fuel burn, low carbon footprint, much lower than the, you know, the coaxial jet engines that went before it. Right. You know, so the 747 was an ecological option as well as an economical option. And it always made sense, you know, for big airlines to buy this because you could move lots of people for the same cost as a 707. So why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah.
Plus freight, you know, tons and tons of freight.
There's really no comparison. I mean, I guess the 777-300 is going to be the closest thing. I mean, other than the Antonovs, the 747 freighter, it will live on for quite a while as a freighter.
Well, Atlas reckon the last one that they've had delivered is probably going to do another 35 to 40 years in service, unless something changes markedly. You know, that they're looking at 35 to 40 years. So the airplanes are going to be around for a while. Bearing in mind, I think the last 100 only retired less than a year ago. So, you know, SPs are still around. There's a couple of SPs still flying around. You know, the last 300s are probably gone now, but there's a lot of 400 passenger ones that have been converted to freighters. Which we'll see, and you know, the last passenger 400s and 8Is are still around. So, you know, we're going to see it for a long time. The new Air Force One, you know, and the new replacements for the Doomsday airplane for the Night Watch aircraft are going to be 747-8Is brought from Lufthansa and Korean Air. So, you know, they're going to be repurposed. So
effectively, they're going to outlive me. Well, me. I mean, maybe not outlive. I mean, I'm 48. Maybe they will outlive me.
Who knows?
They will certainly outlive my career.
the way things are going, it's going to outlive all of us because we're living the good life. Yeah,
true. Yeah. So go ahead.
Yeah, Mike. I was going to say what are those ex Lufthansa eights that have just came over to the U.S.
So do you know anything about those? So a couple of them are going to be training airplanes. In fact, I think one was flying the other day. So they're going to be used as training. So they don't put hours on the actual VC-25Bs that they can eke them out longer. So at the moment, if you want to go training in an Air Force One, the only way to go training in Air Force One, because it's a 200, and there aren't many of those around still, is to actually go flying in the plane. So, you know, I've flown it a couple of times. I've been really fortunate to be in the airplane a couple of times. And they go and do their NDBs and their VOR training and fly their ILSs in the jet. So that puts hours on that airframe that actually are quite precious, particularly, you know, now. So I think with the new aircraft, they've decided what they'll do is they'll buy some stock aircraft from Lufthansa, and they'll just fly them around white-tailed as training airplanes. So, or at least one of them as a training airplane. It was doing circuits at Andrews a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, that will put hours on these airplanes and save the VC-25s for presidential work. So actually the longevity of the actual platform will be much longer. You know, they're probably looking at a 35-year life on those platforms of EC-25Bs. I mean, the existing ones must be pretty close to 35 now. I think it was 1990 they were delivered. So, yeah. Okay. It's interesting because they took delivery of that airplane in 1990 when Boeing was actually making the 400 at that point. Delivered, because it took so long to build these aircraft because they were bespoke. It's a 200 airframe that has 300 wing and it has the 400 freighter gear and 400 engines. So it's a bit of a hybrid.
Does it have a flight engineer station?
It does have a flight engineer, yeah. Yeah, because it's a 200 airframe. Yeah. Okay. So it also has a navigator station as well, which sits kind of behind the flight engineer. Now, the reason it has that is because obviously there's a lot of military stuff on board, right, which they can't integrate into the front because the front is very old. So they integrate this stuff into the navigator station, and the navigator what's it all back from there. GPS, for example, there was no GPS in it when it was delivered. So to make it RNAV compatible, they have to have a GPS fitted to the back, and it's relayed to the front on two very small screens at the front. It's had a lot of upgrades in its life, but it is coming to the end of its life. You know, it costs about $250,000 an hour to operate the airplane.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's their own figures. So if that's what they're quoting as their own figures, you can guarantee that it's more than that.
It's more. It's definitely yeah. more. I mean, and that takes into consideration all the hours of cleaning and maintenance. Oh, I mean, yeah. It's 24/7 that the airplane is being maintained.
It
I
is. Mean, 24/7. And hand polished. Every time it comes back, it's hand polished, the entire airplane. But also, you've got to remember, this is a 200. So if you need parts for this now, they've either got to be manufactured, which is costly, or you have to go out to the desert, find the part, and then come back and have that part reconditioned to put into Air Force One. That's not a great way to have an airplane.
Definitely not.
It's an amazing plane. It's done some amazing stuff, and the book hopefully gives it a bit of a seeing off. It's the last project, 747 project, that Boeing will support is this book. So, because it's a legacy project now, they've sunsetted it. So this was the last project they were ever going to support on this. So,
well, the next one will have to be the next one will have to be Dreamliner.
I got an idea what the next one's going to be, and it's not going to be any of those.
Okay. Well, listen, Scott, it's been awesome. We're going to have you on more. We got to have you on for like the regular episode where we just hang and like get your input on the wacky stuff. We just have to make the time zones work. Yeah.
Yeah. We have some great conversations just about nothing, which is that's exactly what a podcast is, isn't it?
It is. It is. And people tend to like it. I didn't believe it until I saw it, but, where can people get your book, Scott?
So you can buy my book on Amazon. If you're in the US, you have to select the UK store. Otherwise, the US, you can only get the ebook and the audiobook. The hard copy isn't available in the US at the moment.
It's not subject to 37% tariffs, is it?
It is not. It's a licensing issue because I'm signed with Penguin UK. It has to go to the UK for a certain period before it goes somewhere else. If you want to buy it, you can buy it on the UK store on Amazon just by selecting the UK store, click on the link, and they'll send it to you. And it might actually be cheaper than buying it in the US. But
all right, I might have to buy it soon.
I'm going to be coming around your neck of the woods very soon. So actually, I will bring one. And actually, Bob, I'm coming to your neck of the woods at the end of next month as well. So I'll bring one to you excellent. As well, and we'll catch up.
Oh, fantastic.
Up.
Well, yeah, I can't wait to see you. And if Richard Branson would stop hoarding our books, maybe we would get one.
He hasn't got one either.
He hasn't gotten it either. Anything else you want to plug, Scott?
Well, at the moment, if you like Jumbo, Hercules is always available. And that is available in the US on the Amazon store. A great story about some amazing stories. And I know that recently Israel hasn't been top of everyone's list, but there is an amazing story in Hercules about the most audacious raid, I think, that's ever been carried out by a transport airplane, the raid on Entebbe, to rescue the Israeli hostages from Entebbe. You know, had the opportunity to sit down with Brigadier Shani and just talk through it with him. And, you know, he flew that airplane at 0 feet in formation in the dark for about 5,000 miles. You know, four airplanes. And it's just, the story is just fantastic. It's one of those stories when you hear it from, you know, out of his mouth. If I didn't hear it out of his mouth, I'd have thought, he's making this up. You know, but he wasn't, you know, he really did it. And the book tells that story and a number of others, which are all equally bonkers in their own way, but nothing quite as audacious as that raid. And obviously, we're going to be doing more of this, and more podcasting. I'm thinking about doing my own podcast, and obviously, do more video stuff. And if people want to follow me, they can follow me on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, at Scotty Bateman there, and on Instagram at Scotty Bateman _.
All yeah, right. Absolutely. You always have some great, interesting stuff. I follow you on X, of course, and I'm always reading your posts.
Thanks,
man. Well, maybe we'll see you in Denver next month. I'm not announcing anything yet, but there may be some Denver in our future. Stay tuned on that.
Oh no, definitely. Let's do that. I'm really surprised, and maybe there might be a clue why we're going to Denver over here.
There might be a clue on my head as well.
Oh yeah, yeah.
If you're watching the YouTube version. Yeah, where did you get that model, by the way?
Oh, you didn't get a model.
No, I got the hat and the t-shirt and some keychains and
that might be the difference between really good friends of Boom and just friends of Boom.
Ooh, I must be not any friend of Boom, because I got nothing. Did you not get anything? No hat. I didn't get a keychain. Nothing.
Blake is a great guy, and when I went to the factory to the headquarters, and we had a wander around, and we talked about lots and lots of things, and it was a great afternoon actually. And I said, as I'm walking out, there was this amazing big model, and at that point he didn't have any models to give to anyone. And I said, I want one of those. And he says, oh, no, we've only got one, blah, 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 blah. And then Christmas came along, and probably the same box as you got, Steve. They sent out these amazing, huge boxes at Christmas to everyone who supported them on social media and stuff like that. And there was a hat, a t-shirt, a load of stickers, and some, you know, amazing key rings, actually, some really cool key rings. And yeah, in my one, there was a model.
Man.
Steve.
Well, maybe if we go to Denver and we do, you know, we impress Blake. Blake is a great guy. I mean, he's always open. Like, we've had some interesting conversations offline and online. I mean, I follow his socials. It's just an awesome program. I can't wait for this thing to progress. It's amazing how far they've gotten, and without a lot of support. Yeah.
Yeah.
With
making their own engines.
They are building Concorde with nothing. If you imagine the money that was plowed into the Concorde program and the 2707, you know, the Boeing SST, and to an extent the Tupolev as well, the 144, all of those programs had in modern terms, billions and billions spent on them. And he's doing it himself. Not literally himself, but there's no government funding. You know, he isn't a Boeing, he isn't a Lockheed Martin. This is all private money. The first private supersonic aircraft ever was the X-1, you know, so tick, he's there, you know. And I've seen the cockpit mock-up and flown it, you know, it is stunning. You know, the cabin mock-up, you know, this is going to be an amazing airplane. And you know, they're probably going to flip a coin, and Blake will probably tell me off for telling people, but they're probably 3 years away from having a flying airplane.
Wow.
You know, that's
supersonic airliner.
That is unbelievable.
That's unbelievable. You know what? I mean, look, Blake was generous enough with his time to offer us to come out there, and we're trying to make the schedule work sometime in the next month and a half. It may work out where Scotty's going to be able to come join us as well. So maybe bring some camera crews so I can actually enjoy myself instead of just sitting behind a camera.
Following me around with a camera.
Following Captain Bob the way I do. Anyway, things to look forward to on the Cockpit Casual Pod. Scott, thank you so much for joining
us. Anytime, guys. You know that.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and we appreciate it. Always great talking to you, Scotty. I love it.
Absolutely. All right. Take care.
Cheers, guys.
Good night.